that wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.
Portland.
Check out Ear to the Streets of Portland with hosts Sequoina
and Kayla
every first and third Thursday of the month starting at 7 o'clock p.m.
Listen in as we interview community organizers, speak on issues focused on Black Portland, and share community events happening in the area and elsewhere.
Listen on the radio at 90.7 FM, online at www.kbu.fm, or from your mobile phone at m.kbu.fm.
Follow KBU on Instagram at KBU Radio. Ear to the Streets.
Here at KBU, we honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on. The Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, Wetlala Bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin Kalapuya, and many other indigenous tribes and nations of the region of the Willamette River and that great river known as Shuaneku, Wimal, Nishaiwana, and Columbia. Many names for the living water force that has sustained this region for countless generations and provided phenomenal life to our blessed ecosystems. We believe it is important to acknowledge the ancestors of this land and to recognize that we are here because of the sacrifices forced upon them. In remembering these communities, we honor their legacy, their lives, and their descendants with the forming of relationships to each other and the living world.
Hello, and you are listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350 Climate Action. Our show presents environmental and climate stories from a social justice frame, featuring voices not necessarily heard on mainstream media. Welcome, I am Jack Eit. On today's show, how the soil sponge and essential biological workers are changing the world. Host Carrie Kim will be interviewing Dee Dee Pursehouse, founder of Land and Leadership Initiative. Dee Dee Pursehouse is the author of two books. The first is The Ecology of Care, Medicine, Agriculture, Money, and the Quiet Power of Human and Microbial Communities. Her second is Understanding Soil Health and Watershed Function. A well-known writer and teacher, she specializes in how to grow what is called the soil sponge, a way to provide abundant water and food for all life while establishing resilience to flooding, drought, and wildfires. She understands other plants, animals, bugs, and microbes as essential workers, stressing the vital role of the biological workforce in regulating the out-of-control climate.
Aloha, this is Carrie Kim. Listeners, thank you for joining us for a deep conversation with renowned writer, teacher, and educator, Dee Dee Pursehouse, about how soil health may be the one movement that will heal and unify the world. First, we'd like to thank the Tongva ancestors for their continuing presence, legacy, and stewardship of this region. Our show comes to you from the ancestral homelands of the Tongva and all of their relatives. We invite you to align with and support local First Nations wherever you live, their homelands and their lifeways. The Earth's water cycle, carbon cycle, and nutrient cycle depend on a healthy soil sponge, which is created and maintained by the ongoing work of other species. By restoring and nurturing the soil sponge, humanity has a unique opportunity to unify and come into balance with all life, particularly the world's essential workers, plants, fungi, bacteria, worms, insects, and other often unseen underground workers. These beings together create the soil sponge, the basic infrastructure or living matrix that makes life on land possible. When the soil sponge fails on a small scale, local farms and small ecosystems collapse. When it fails on a large scale, whole regions and societies collapse. Regenerating the health of the world's soils means fewer floods, droughts, and wildfires, improved air quality, less need for irrigation, cleaner and more abundant water, a balanced climate, less erosion, greater biodiversity, and less spending on public health and disaster recovery. Dee Dee Pursehouse, founder of the Land and Leadership Initiative, joins us today to share how we might allow nature to lead, how we might collaborate with other species and ensure the soil sponge remains healthy and functional for future generations. In doing so, the world's most pressing challenges can be resolved. Welcome, Dee Dee. It has been a long time coming, and we are so
grateful.
Here you are in the flesh. My God, I have to pinch myself. We are in your debt for the commitment you made so long ago to the soil sponge and promoting planetary health. You know, moons ago, what was it about the book Cows Save the World that catapulted you to change course from being an acupuncturist to being a soil and planetary educator?
Well, I'm going to go back even a little bit further because there are several points. And one of them, I was just remembering last night that I went to a talk, oh gosh, probably in 2000 and maybe three or four by Jim Merkel, who wrote a book called Radical Simplicity. Very, very interesting book and a very interesting person. Jim Merkel had been, grew up in a family of 12 or 14 people. His dad was a truck driver, and then he worked as a like international arms dealer and had a change of heart and became this like person living a very simple life and biking to work and preaching about simple living. And that was it certainly aligned very much with my work as a holistic healthcare provider and got me thinking about the concept of peak oil and thinking like, what is that intersection between sustainable living and alternative health? And that really came to fruition. There was a conference here that one floor, it was kind of an expo, one floor of it was sustainable living and the second floor was all alternative health. Mm-hmm. And the night before I thought, what is the connection there? Like, why are those two part of the same expo? It makes perfect sense, but why? Yeah. And I actually wrote up a set of like 12 premises and into a manifesto called the Ecological Medicine Manifesto, of looking at things like our health is nested within the health of the whole, and kind of carrying on from there. So everything from the microbiome up to, you know, how the ecosystem heals us, and that we therefore have a responsibility to the whole if we want everything to work. That piece of paper, which I handed out to like 400 people at that expo, became kind of the foundation for writing The Ecology of Care, my first book. And while I was writing that book, it was 9 years in the writing, Hurricane Irene, which called here Tropical Storm Irene, tore through Vermont and really did tremendous damage to our roadways, which of course were all built along little deer paths, you know, through the woods that became footpaths, that became horse paths and roads eventually, which all were ripped apart by this storm. Mm-hmm. And I got very interested at that point in climate change through the lens of water. And at that point, started reading more widely on climate change and found Judith Schwartz's book, Cows Save the Planet, that actually tied together a whole bunch of things I had was trying to connect in my draft of my manuscript at that point through the lens of animals participating in the whole cycle in terms of creating the climate. At that point, that was just through the carbon lens. And I got about halfway through her book and said, this is what I want to do when I grow up at age.
And what you've done.
And literally the next morning got up and started calling people and saying, who do you know who's working on soils? And started really focusing on what I sometimes call soil health as public health, but it's much broader than that.
Right. Soil health is planetary health. You know, it gets bigger and bigger, right? You know, people, as you've said, you know, people often focus on carbon when speaking about climate change, but you know that it's essential that people connect the dots between climate change and water. Wondering if you could address at least some of that. I know we could be holed up with you for like a month talking about this, but.
Well, I think the best way into that is through the topic of the soil sponge, because the soil sponge is in a sense where those two come together, and plant also, that they're inseparable, right? The soil sponge is in a continuum with the atmosphere, plants, microbes, all of soil life, all the grazing animals, right? And then the mineral matter that are, you know, sort of the rock of our planet as it turns into sand, silt, and clay, the basic mineral particles of soil. And when soils are degraded by not understanding what it takes, that it takes a village of other species to make an actual soil that actually works the way we expect it to. Mm-hmm. If we don't understand that and we treat it as if it's just a pile of dirt, then the soil degrades back to just the mineral particles. So there's basically no more life in it, and it doesn't have any structural integrity or functional integrity. I often compare that when I'm teaching in person to a pile of flour. And if you put a pile of like white flour onto a plate and poke some holes in a cup and rain on it, that's like degraded soil. And what happens is the water runs off. You get flooding. Mm-hmm. You get a crusting on the soil as that dries. Mm-hmm. If you lift up that crust, it's completely dry underneath. So there's no water going down for the plant roots. Mm-hmm. You get erosion and mudslides. And then ultimately, you also have drought. So flooding and drought are two sides of the same issue related to degraded soils. However, if you have biology working in soils and you have plants taking CO2 from the atmosphere, turning it first into themselves, turning it into food for all life through the food chain, both above ground and below ground, and then life, including the plant roots, the mycorrhizal fungi, all of the bacteria, all of the other life in the soil, starts creating this matrix like a sponge underground. It has space for air and water for life underground, like lots of little pore spaces and tunnels. Okay. And life starts moving through there to make more of these tunnels and spaces. Then you have what I call the soil sponge, or sometimes it's the soil carbon sponge, but people get a little, that sometimes people
live on that.
So that's more like bread. So I'll take a few slices of bread and pile them up, and you can rain on that same little landscape where there's pores and there's structural integrity, and the water soaks in instantly. It doesn't run off. It's held there. It's protected from evaporation. The soil doesn't fall apart. Even if you pick up the two plates and blow on them, right? If the wind comes along, one's going to blow away, the other isn't. And it's also getting filtered and cleaned as it goes down. So when it does finally come back out through like springs in the land or wells, you have clean, beautiful water for all of life.
And so recharging the aquifers.
And recharging the aquifers. Now, how that relates to climate, I mean, obviously, climate resilience is very much part of that, right? That we have a lot of resilience to flooding and a lot of resilience to drought and a lot of resilience to wildfire in that soil sponge or bread-like landscape, because plants have enough water, all other life has enough water. There's so many, you know, if the soils aren't blowing, then they're not landing on snowfields and glaciers, which then aren't melting as quickly, which then, you know, are also providing more albedo and cooling. There's like every aspect that we think of climate change is addressed through the soil sponge, including ocean, you know, sea level rise is reduced.
Well, I think that was really important. And you talking about also the sea level rise, because people don't often connect the dots between soil and water. And I just feel that it's just our fundamental education is sorely lacking around soil health, biology, watershed function. This is all what I feel is actually compulsory education for any human being living on the planet. Mm-hmm. We should understand this. It should be something fundamental. It's much more important than anything else we've ever learned in, you know, quote unquote, regular school, conventional schools. Mm-hmm. How do you feel that people can be educated and actually reclaim this knowledge or begin to understand, you know, because they really lost this understanding now, especially, you know, the younger generations? They don't grow up with an understanding of biology, and many of them are not even spending time outdoors these days. So can you speak about the education?
Yeah, I'll say in the United States, the next generation science standards for high school, and I think they also apply to middle school or maybe even all the way through, but they're well written, and their intention is correct in terms of really getting people to see how land works in many ways. Teachers aren't given a lot of help with knowing how to turn that into curriculum, right? They don't have time to do that. But the thing that's usually missing at whatever level of education, and my focus is always on adult education, even though I wrote curriculum for high schools, the thing that's usually missing is starting with a whole, you know, starting by looking at how a whole landscape, a whole watershed, a whole catchment works, or a whole town, or, you know, but looking, so biology tends to teach, you know, photosynthesis this week, and then transpiration this other week, and then soil structure as if it's just sand, salt, and clay another week, or maybe even another month, without starting with getting people saying, okay, let's just take an hour and look at the whole thing working at once.
Right.
And I don't think people know how to do that well. And that's what I've been focusing on trying to create are some simple ways to tell that story, so that then all the rest of it becomes much more interesting. I was never interested in photosynthesis transpiration until I understood, like, that's how the atmosphere is created. That's how clouds are created. That's how rain comes back down. That's how weather systems are created. We haven't even gotten into that today.
Well, but I think that's what one of your incredible gifts is that you make it more accessible and understandable for people to really connect all of the dots of biology and ecology, and to understand in a way that is not so abstract or scientific or academic. You make it much more real for their own daily lives.
That's what I try to do.
And you're very skilled at doing that. You know, can you also explain a bit about the relationship of water and the carbon cycle? And also just understanding carbon as a cycle instead of as a thing.
Yeah, so what we were just describing, you know, that sort of flour versus bread, right? If plants then have enough water at their root zone, right? Because the soils are absorbing it. Well, there's a lot of carbon in the soil, because carbon is what life is made out of. People talk about, you know, low carbon this and getting rid of carbon. We don't want to get rid of carbon.
We need it to survive, right?
So it's really important to understand that plants don't just cycle carbon. Plants are actually making themselves out of carbon. Mm-hmm. And then plants are in feeding that carbon as sugars to all of life, or as their leaves and their roots, et cetera, to all of life. Mm-hmm. Plants are taking atmospheric carbon, putting it into life, which then breathes back out CO2, Mm-hmm. And that CO2 is part of the atmosphere, and it's part of what we need for a climate that we can live in. And water is a necessary ingredient for plants to photosynthesize. Mm-hmm. So if plants don't have water at the root zone, they can't do their job of actually regulating the carbon cycle.
Exactly. That's the imbalance. Like you talk about, it's the whole system, and the whole system needs to be in balance.
Yeah, and it's really key, like, that carbon is not a problem. Carbon is life, and life is at work moving carbon around. Mm-hmm. And also that greenhouse gases are absolutely necessary. The greenhouse effect, we could not live on this planet without the greenhouse effect. We would be, you know, in this extreme temperatures of outer space. So it's not a matter of, like, getting rid of greenhouse gases. It's a matter of getting back into balance where we need to be. And it's actually a fairly small shift that is needed.
Well, if you can talk about also, I know, you know, you've worked a lot with Walter Yena, soil microbiologist, and, you know, he will say that, you know, water is the primary greenhouse gas. If you could talk about water in that sense, that it is, because people don't know that. People don't understand that.
Yes. So, and I want to be careful how we say that, because people hear that and then they say, oh, we have to get rid of water, right?
Because that's always we get all the time. I know. Right.
So water is the primary greenhouse gas, and the greenhouse gases also include CO2 that everyone knows about, and methane and other gases. Mm-hmm. And all of those gases are meant to cycle through living systems. Mm-hmm. And it's not, and we don't need less greenhouse gases, we need them to keep cycling and moving into the right forms. So there's just a time, I mean, I guess technically we need a little less greenhouse gases, but it's so compared to what we can do on land, mm-hmm. by keeping water and CO2 moving through living systems that's where we need to keep the focus, not on kind of stopping greenhouse gases. So
I think that always tends to be sort of a solutionizing way of doing things, that you find the demon and you kill the demon, and that gets repeated over and over again. But it really is not, it's not a balanced way of looking at the world, or, as you say, looking at living systems, because people, that fundamental understanding needs to be there.
And I call that the sterile model of approaching, you know, human health and landscape health, is to figure out what's wrong and kill it, exactly. As opposed to a fertile model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems to be something
fertile paradigm.
We've been doing that for thousands of years. So, you know, it seems obvious that we can cool a region simply by planting more plants. But, you know, what regions or countries do you feel are succeeding in doing this at a larger scale? I know you've been working with people in Andhra Pradesh, and where do you feel that this is really happening in a significant way?
I'm noting that there's a break time. I don't know if you... We need to take that break.
Yes. Thanks, Didi. We're going to take a break. And we'll come right back and speak more about planting more plants.
Hey, listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying EcoJustice Radio. Stay connected by subscribing on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, to check out previous shows and guests and get connected with us on social media. Today you're listening to How the Soil Sponge and Essential Biological Workers Are Changing the World, with host Carrie Kim and guest Didi Pursehaus, founder of Land and Leadership Initiative.
So Didi, if you could speak a bit about transpiration, it was something you wanted to double back on.
Yeah, because I think when we think about how plants actually regulate the climate, there are two different ways that they do that. One is through the carbon cycle, mm-hmm. Which we were just talking about, that they take CO2 and turn it into life, including themselves. Mm-hmm. And then life breathes that back out as CO2, and that keeps cycling. The other big way that they regulate the climate is through transpiration, which is like sweating in plants. It happens whenever they're photosynthesizing or doing that thing with CO2, they're also transpiring, except for a few plants that like cacti that do something a little bit differently. But transpiring is like sweating, and it's taking that water that they're taking up from their roots and taking it from a liquid form and emitting it as a gas as it evaporates from their leaves. And whenever water changes phase like that from a liquid to a gas, mm-hmm. it actually cools, which is why if we sweat, we cool off.
Right.
And so plants are cooling themselves by doing that,
mm-hmm.
but they're also cooling the air around them.
Right.
And they're also, when water's evaporating from the soil, you know, sort of gradually from the sponge, it's also cooling. And that's one of the reasons that if you take off your shoes and you're standing on hot pavement and there's bare soil and then there's like plants next to you, it would be cooler to go to the bare soil because it's a lighter color usually than the pavement, but mm-hmm. it would be much cooler to jump onto the grass or the meadow, et cetera, because there's water evaporating mm-hmm. from that sponge. And there's also like an insulating effect of the air and water that's in the sponge. So that is cooling right at the regional level, at the surface level.
Mm-hmm.
And as that air cools, and there, it's a little bit more complex than that because it also recondenses like into mists and then it evaporates again. So it's kind of doing this over and over again, but it's moving the heat away from the surface of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's creating a low pressure zone.
Okay.
Like a cool low pressure zone, which sucks in high pressure air or allows high pressure air to move in. And it actually brings moisture in from the coasts inland.
Mm-hmm.
So that we're actually having so we don't have these huge storms at
right.
the coasts and then drought in the center. We have more spread out rainfall across a continent. And
mm-hmm.
that's called the biotic pump theory. Biotic meaning, you know, that biology is actually pumping water across a
mm-hmm.
continent.
Well, it's so important. I mean, maybe you could explain a little bit of how we have these extreme rain events too, when with the pressure systems and how that happens with what's happening with climate
yeah.
change.
Yeah, if you think about an area where there's sort of bare soil inland, right? That then you don't have that transpiration happening. You also have like a darker surface that's collecting heat and you end up with high pressure, right? Or you have, and then you have a different kind of high pressure from all of the moisture at the, you know, coming up from the oceans. Those two zones are sort of fighting for space and the storm just keeps like circling around
yeah.
and
mm-hmm.
you end up with a big, long, long, long rainstorm. And the same thing could happen inland if you have an area that is transpiring and then you have other areas that are bare around that the weather gets blocked and
mm-hmm.
so the water that does evaporate and that does get these biological rain formation, that's a whole other story, that there are bacteria
right.
in the air that are helping the water to form into raindrops and come back down again if you have a biologically functional landscape.
Right.
So
versus
so,
having like an intense storms or these rainstorms that are just, you know, the biblical level rainstorms, you know, 1 in 500 year events, these things.
Yeah, that's often got drought in between, right? So yeah, so what we want is we want biology. We want diverse plants, forests, etc., that support diverse other species spread out across a continent, so that those weather systems can move across the continent, and so that they are constantly replenishing the water locally. It's like a local water cycle, rather than just relying on the ocean evaporating for the water.
When people talk about the small water cycle and the big water cycle, could you speak a little bit about that, Dee Dee?
Yeah, so that's what that small water cycle is plants, you know, is a functional soil sponge that has a lot of structural integrity and mm-hmm. is holding water when rain does fall, and then is making it available to plants,
mm-hmm.
and then the plants are transpiring that water up, and then the plant volatile organic compounds, which is what smells wonderful in a forest, those are
mm-hmm.
helping to recondense that water into mists and rain clouds. And then bacteria are actually taking those little cloud particles, you know, the little tiny bits of condensed water, and condensing them into something large enough to fall back down again. And that's that whole local water cycle. And if you think about a place like a very, you know, very densely forested, you know, rainforest or something, it's called a rainforest because it's literally making its own rain every day.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then the big water cycle
is that water evaporating off of the oceans mm-hmm. and forming clouds over the oceans that then with various different things that affect weather, including pressure zones, et cetera, that brings that water across the land if it's working right.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's just raining back down in the oceans, or it's collecting into like hurricanes, et cetera.
And you have these big water events, right? I know you had mentioned also speaking about places like here on Tongalands, aka Los Angeles, about not being able to have the rain come back down, you know, talking about pollution and things like the particulate matter that is preventing that water cycle and the rain coming down in place.
Yeah, so what happens when we have I talk about like the biotic climate or biotic water cycle, so one I was just describing, and then I talk about like the antibiotic cycle where we've literally killed off, you know, the biology so it can't do its work. So those essential workers in the world are no longer there. And an example of that would be that because the beaver were killed off in California in part in order to claim land, you know, I'm going to just kill these off. And so there's nothing here for anyone else. And so then the wetlands were destroyed that mm-hmm. the beaver had made, and mm-hmm. the water was put into, you know, channelized, right? And then the soils were tilled until the soil sponge was no longer accepting water. And then the croplands were often bare in between the crops or bare in between crop cycles, so that there were no longer plants to rebuild the soil sponge or feed the biology that's needed to keep the water cycle going. So then we end up with I'll just give an example that the Central Valley, rather than being this place that's creating these cool low pressure zones that's pulling the water up over the coastal range into the Central Valley, and that there are trees on both coastal range and the Sierras? I'm not in California. That both of those should have trees that are actually helping to capture water and drip it down, right? Mm-hmm. Capture mists that then help to create the water cycle as it goes across. Mm-hmm. Instead, we just have a big hot heat dome over the Central Valley. We have pollutants from the soil, the dry, bare, flower-like soil going into the air. So we have a lot of dust. You know, you often can't see the mountains from some places in the Central Valley. Mm-hmm. And you have the pollutants from industry, from cars, from other things that are becoming, from forest fires now, from becoming airborne. Those can condense water on them mm-hmm. and it turns into humid hazes. Uh-huh. And you could have a high humidity and no rain, right? We see this all the time. But there isn't the biology to help create something large enough to form a nice, big, fluffy, white, cooling cloud, or to form the raindrops that need to fall to get that water back to land.
So important for
people. We have humid hazes that just are a sticky blanket trapping heat. And another really key thing here is that in a biotic water cycle, you often will have an afternoon thunder shower every day that the water comes mm-hmm. back down in the afternoon. And then you have clear skies at night. You can see all the stars and all the heat that's collected during the day gets mm-hmm. to escape back out to space at night. If you have a humid haze there, it doesn't rain and it doesn't leave. So the heat that has collected stays, and we think about those heat waves where it gets hotter and hotter and hotter and it doesn't break. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the global warming, which is the average temperature going up, rises in nighttime temperatures.
Oh, okay.
And so a lot of what we're experiencing as global warming is that we don't have that nighttime radiation window open for the heat to leave. That requires biology.
Well, we have that a lot, and people can witness that here just driving around. We have the haze all the time. I mean, I think the haze is the same as global dimming, is it? The same thing?
Yeah. And it has a little bit of a cooling effect, but it really ultimately is a warming effect. You know, it's a little cooling in that the sun can't get through quite as much, mm-hmm. but it's also trapping heat in the air. And so ultimately, it's more of a warming.
You know, could you share a bit more about the intelligence present in soil? Because it seems an imperative that we understand that soil is intelligent and the intelligence of all the essential workers in the soil. We really need to respect more what they do and how they allow us to live here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'll say that when I was researching and writing my book, over and over and over again, I'd come across a book written by very smart, respected people. And within the first few pages of the book, there would be some phrase about that humans are different than other life because we have intelligence or we have consciousness or we can think. And I always sort of lost a little respect for these authors that I respected, because it's like, what do you know about what consciousness is like in another species, right? Yeah. It's like saying, bicycle doesn't have a motor, therefore it can't go. You know, like, oh, that thing doesn't have a brain, therefore it doesn't have consciousness. So, but in the soil, I believe that all living things are deeply intelligent, and that humans are, you know, if you look at our track record, we're maybe
up there. Maybe at least intelligent, at least acting on intelligence anyway.
But one of the most amazing things that's happening in the soil is the communication between plants and bacteria, but even more so the mycorrhizal fungi. Mm-hmm. And the mycorrhizal fungi are fungi, they're not the same as the decomposers that make mushrooms. They're actually fungi that connect into the plant roots themselves and then go move out through the soil in search of nutrients and hidden water to be able to bring it back to the plants. But there's a constant exchange of information going back and forth so that the mycorrhizal fungi know exactly what that plant needs at that time and in what ratio and what balance to bring it back, and can go hunting out and finding it, and helps to facilitate communication between plant communities.
That communication is so fascinating. You know, if only we could understand their language.
We're speaking to, there's a lot of great work out there. Suzanne Simard and other people are starting to write and speak more about what they're learning. And forests have like family dynamics and community dynamics and essentially conversations going on all the time through chemical signaling and probably all kinds of other ways. Yeah. But these mycorrhizal fungi are a really key aspect of the health and the communication going on within a plant community. And they're long threads, you know, in a cubic meter of soil, there could be the 250,000 kilometers of mycorrhizal fungi. And that's like twice the diameter of the earth in one, basically a square, you know, a square yard or square meter of soil.
Is that people, what they don't see, they don't understand, you know, they don't know that it exists. And why it's so important, like the work of Elaine Ingham and the things that you're doing for people to understand what actually lives beneath the soil and beyond the human eye's capacity to see.
And my entry into that was partly through thinking about the microbiome in our guts, which in many ways is a similar thing, that there, you know, our gut microorganisms are making most or all of our neurotransmitters. I mean, they are regulating our metabolism and our immunity. There's like, there's all this communication going on within our body, and not just in our gut, right? Turns out we have a microbiome all over the place.
We're more microorganisms than human, as people say.
We even have like an air microbiome around us, the way that the atmosphere has bacteria in it too. So.
Yeah, this is all learning that we need. You know, you capitalize, going back to what you were saying about respecting biological workers and other species. You know, you said that we've been taught that nature is there as a resource for us to use, B, a force that we are at war with, or a victim for us to protect. So what's the risk? Because people often do have that also. We know about resources, and there is a lot of this militaristic viewpoint of the demonizing and the kill this, kill that, pesticides. But what's the danger in perceiving nature as a victim that we need to protect, like we need to save this and save that, that kind of savior mentality. Can you elaborate on that?
I think one way to get at this is there's a wonderful framework that's used in a change agent development community that I'm within, and that I also use this in the land and leadership development community that I steward. Mm-hmm. And it's four phrases with little up arrows in between them. And these are paradigms, like ways that we can look at a living system. And we all fall into all of these, right? We all go through this every day. So they're only to be used to evaluate where you are looking from, not to use to judge someone else. So I can look, I'll speak in first person. I can look at, you know, the woods around me as something that I can extract value from. So the lowest level is like extracting value. Like I can say, oh, how much money could I make if I cut these trees? I'd like to have more light in my living room. Maybe I should cut some more. Or maybe I could subdivide the land and have, you know, and to cut down. So, and I do. I think about all those things every day, right? I mean, it's the part of modern life is that we want things. Mm-hmm. I can also look at it as like from an arrest disorder paradigm of like, what do I need to stop? I need to stop the flooding that's coming into my basement because there's a stream next to me. I need to stop this pest or that pest in the garden. I need to stop people from logging because the trees are so important, right? And then I can be in sort of fight mode all day long, mm-hmm. with nature or with people. And then the third one that gets to your question is the do good paradigm, where mm-hmm. I'm seeing myself as someone who's going to be benevolent, and I'm going to feel good about myself, and I'm going to try to do everything right, and I'm going to try to protect vulnerable populations, etc. And there's nothing wrong with that. Lots of great things are happening from that paradigm, mm-hmm. And I can certainly go there myself, but our idea of what needs protecting is often, at, you know, not the same as someone else's, and right. Very often the funding for those do good projects is coming from an extract value economy.
Mm-hmm. So Didi, hold that thought. We're going to come back and we'll
double. Oh, we got one more thing. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, we've got one more thing. I know. We're going to come back and get the one more thing from you.
Hey, listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying EcoJustice Radio. Stay connected by subscribing on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org. to check out previous shows and guests and get connected with us on social media. Today you're listening to How the Soil Sponge and Essential Biological Workers Are Changing the World, with host Carrie Kim and guest Didi Pursehaus, founder of Land and Leadership Initiative.
So Didi, if you could reiterate the first three that we reviewed, and then there was a fourth one you wanted to say. We were talking about the extractive way of looking at things and then the arrest and disorder. If you could reiterate those for listeners.
Yeah, so these are paradigms that we can look at living systems through that we can use to also evaluate where we're looking from at any moment. So the lowest level is looking at something to how much value can I extract from this? What can I get from this without giving so much? Mm-hmm. The second is, how do I stop bad things from happening? Or how do I arrest disorder is the language we would use for that paradigm. The third is, how can I do good? How can I be benevolent, help things, rescue the victim of nature? Mm-hmm. But the fourth one is really powerful, and it's the one that we often forget is even an option. And that is, how can I grow the capacity of the whole? Mm. Including myself nested within this system.
I love that.
And another way of saying that is, how can I regenerate life? How can I create more and more conditions for life to flourish here?
That sums it all up right there. I mean, you can just move through those and see, like, even just how you feel hearing it, that makes the most sense. Period.
and if you are really trying to hold yourself, because again, these are to be applied to yourself, not to criticize others. If you hold yourself to trying to think and design and plan and act from that highest paradigm, there are times and places for all of the lower three. If they're held within that container of my aim here is this, there are people and other species that need to be fed, and we need to be kind and caring. And sometimes there is a flood in the basement and you need to quickly patch something up or even dig a big hole like I had to do last week.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, I think the difficulty is where, when righteousness kind of sneaks into this paradigmatic way of looking at things, because we can get very righteous and then that creates that separation. And I know you've been very focused on collaborations between people and different kinds of people and beyond political parties and so forth, that they're working for, that we're working more for a collaborative, like, common goal, which is planetary health. And then that kind of transcends all these other differences that can come up depending on these paradigms. You know, you're right, I'm wrong, etc.
Yes. And I think that, well, one of the things that really has drawn me or drew me to the soil health movement was that when I started being invited to speak at these agricultural conferences focused on soil health, this is mostly within North America for starters, I found that I was with people of very different political stripes, very different economic backgrounds, very different, you know, work in the world or religious backgrounds, who were all seeing this potential for growing the capacity of the system, for regenerating living landscapes, for creating systems where there's abundant food and water for all of life. There's abundant beauty and space for all different kinds of insects and flowers, etc. And some of these folks were people who used to work for Monsanto. Some of these folks are very conservative Republicans. Some of them were people with tie-dyed, you know, rainbow bandanas and you know, backed, and some of them are back to the land hippies, and some of them are back to the land conservatives who are trying to, you know, stake out their spot. And everybody's focused on this thing that they see not only as possible, but that people are actually doing. Right. It's not just like far off in the future. It's like, right, you could walk into the conference room and go get in somebody's pickup truck and drive down the road and see these places where the water is soaking in. You know, it used to be 45 minutes for a cup of water to soak in, and now it's going in 16 seconds.
It's amazing how fast it changes.
A place where there's suddenly all these birds and insects and life that's going on, and it sounds different and it smells different and it looks different. And you walk 100 feet away and there's a dusty old cornfield with like a little layer of like algae growing on the soil. And it's like, wow, this happened in 4 years or, you know. So that is so, when people see life happening, it's very easy for them to come together and go, yeah, we all want that.
Well, I think that fundamental to all of that is understanding that soil is a living system. And when you actually get involved with the soil hands on, it's so magical. I mean, it's so wondrous that it's easy to do what, like you've done, is that you just commit your whole life to that. It's miraculous.
There are a lot of people who are having this kind of big change of heart and going, wow, I want to do this. But you know, there is also a way in which the older or lower paradigms are sneaking in and getting mixed up with it, which is sad to watch.
Kind of like greenwashing, you mean?
Greenwashing and figuring out how do we make a lot of money from this movement.
Right.
And this is the challenge with any really interesting, wonderful movement, is that sort of extract value and arrest disorder paradigms can, if we don't really understand where we are sourcing from, we can all get pulled.
Yeah. Someone will want to capitalize it. I know. I wanted to see if
it's already, it's already happening big time. I'll just say that. Yeah.
Right. So. Right. I wanted to shift a little bit to what we, speaking about food and the relationship of, you know, the food, the microbiome, and what's happening now with technology and biotech coming into the realms of food. You know, what are we losing or missing when we choose foods that have come through machines versus the membranes of nature?
Well, we were talking a few minutes ago about the intelligence of soils, or the intelligence of a living soil plant microbial ecosystem. And one way to look at that I like to talk about is it as layers of membranes. Mm-hmm. And a membrane is the most basic form of intelligence. A membrane, like a cell membrane, for example, decides what needs to come in and in what proportions and what stays out. So what is going to be too much or toxic to the system, mm-hmm. and what is the right amount or nourishing to the system. And when we are eating food that is grown in a living, thriving soil ecosystem, there are multiple layers of membranes that have made those decisions before the plant gets into us, mm-hmm. right? And
decisions, all these conscious decisions.
Yeah. So there's the membrane of the mycorrhizal fungi that I was talking about that is in an interface with the minerals of the soils and is deciding how much to bring in and what to shuttle to which plant and who needs what. And that's in part in response to health challenges that the plants are facing. Mm-hmm. So plants are vulnerable to bacterial, fungal, insect, all kinds of diseases, just like we are, mm-hmm. viral, and including viral things. So there's that membrane. And then there is the bacteria that are around the plant that are also doing that, are also in an exchange with the plant. And they're also bound by an intelligent membrane that's deciding what to keep and what to give. And then, of course, the plant itself has all of these cells that's doing that. And then if you're eating foods from a system that involves grazing animals, then those animals are choosing then with more of their brain and their taste organs, mm-hmm. they're choosing which plants to eat and when, how much, in what order. Read the work of Fred Provenza or a wonderful book called The Dorito Effect that's about Provenza's work about the flavor industry and the intelligence of animals and how it's been sort of hijacked, including our own flavors, mm-hmm. flavor abilities. So those animals then are choosing and deciding and what's healthy for them at any point. And they're given a huge smorgasbord of choices if it's a healthy pasture system, a healthy grazing system. So then by the time that we get that butter or that milk or that meat or those vegetables or et cetera, or those wild berries or avocados or whatever, they have all gone through those membranes. So foods from a wild system where there's really intact soil ecology, or mm-hmm. foods from a grazing system where there's no soil disturbance, and that's not true of all grazing systems, so you need to ask. Those foods have multiple layers of intelligence behind them.
Yeah.
So now what's the opposite? The opposite is, well, first of all, a system where the soil is broken up and tilled all the time. So all those connections are chopped into pieces, right? Mm-hmm. All of those fungi and bacteria are exposed to air and die off. And mm-hmm. then what happens instead is that we give NPK, you know, we give like a few minerals to the plant. The plant just takes it up like a straw.
Mm-hmm.
And it's made out of just like these basic things for life, right. but that don't actually create health in the plant.
Right. It's like being pumped, sustained on drugs, kind of.
Yeah, or just taking like a vitamin pill and not eating any food, right? Which mm-hmm. in a sense, a lot of, you know, people eating sort of protein shakes or whatever as their main diet. That's a little bit like that. Like, oh, we know what you need. You need this much of this.
Right.
And you're not relying on your own flavor, right? You're not relying on your own taste buds of like, what do I actually need and what's in season when, and what is like, what do I need this week because I've got a little cold? Or so we may have that system where we have animals that are in feedlots and being fed awful things like old Twinkies and things like that. Okay. You know, that they're not getting to make any choices.
But, you know, I want to talk about humanity's history. You know, humanity's been in a largely destructive relationship with the soil sponge, as you said, for the last 8,000 years. You know, we're not the first society to destroy our soil. I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit on the relationship of healthy soil and the collapse of civilizations throughout history. You know, just kind of relating that into our time now and how we're repeating something that's been going on for a long time.
So a lot of the areas that we think of as like natural deserts, like the Sahara, are mm-hmm. not natural deserts. The Sahara, the Middle East, etc., were green, lush, you know, cradles of civilization, the land of milk and honey, right? If you read like old texts, there's all this language that's like, wait a minute, where are we talking about?
You know? Right.
Yeah. And because people figured out that they could till land and, you know, and get actually a really great crop, that when you first rototill or till or plow land, there's all kinds of stuff that gets sort of available. Mm-hmm. And that first couple of years is very, very productive. But if you do that year after year, especially certain kinds of soils, like soils that are grasslands, mm-hmm. That naturally want to be grasslands, those systems will collapse quite quickly. Mm-hmm. And we've seen these civilizations rise and fall because of that. And essentially, they rise and fall because their soil is lost. Mm-hmm. So they no longer can grow food or hold water. And then, of mm-hmm. course, they're conflicts there, etc. So then you
go elsewhere and repeat it all over again.
What's that? And then we start all over
again. And repeat it all over again. It's like coming here, like the Europeans coming here, people wanting to go out into space. I mean, it's like, what's the next frontier? We'll ruin this and then we'll go to the next place. But we never really deal with healing the original place and restoring it back to what a state of health.
Yeah. And I just want to say that they're parallel to that. There have been civilizations that understand how to live in a way that is nested within all of the systems that biology is working, you know, is doing, and how to live in a way that makes sense. And so we have that knowledge. We've lost a lot too. It's been going along at the same time. So
I mean, we don't have to look too far on this continent to the indigenous peoples, the original peoples that were living in this way, you know, why it was so, you know, it's such a paradise to come here to see things so fertile and so well taken care of. I mean, I don't want to romanticize all indigenous peoples, but we know that that's the history of the lands here. So Dee Dee, you know, I can't believe that our talk, I feel like I'm just beginning. I have like so many more questions for you, but I wanted to see if you could share with people how they can connect with you, how they can learn from Land and Leadership Initiative and participate and get involved and actually act on behalf of the soil sponge within their own communities and globally as well. What are the ways they can connect?
So there are a few different ways. I have a site called landandleadership.org. And on that site, I think it's under the resources tab, you will find there's a free download of a manual called Understanding Soil Health and Watershed Function. It's a 150-page free facilitator's manual that you can, like that flour versus bread example and various other conversations you can have there that are in there. You can also just sign up for a mailing list. I give a course on the soil sponge and sort of whole systems thinking about land at least 4 times a year. It's a 5-week course. You can sign up for that, landandleadership.org, but specifically going under the courses tab. There's a one that's starting quite soon, but we do them at least quarterly. And then I have an ongoing group called the Land and Leadership Development Community that meets weekly. And that's in some ways the heart of my work, where we are learning to think together about living systems through these living systems frameworks, through deep discussion. It's not an expert, it's not me imparting information. It's really interesting conversations with people from all over the world. And that meets weekly. And if you're interested in that, you can also get in touch through the website.
Listeners, get in contact with Dee Dee and definitely stay connected with her work and participate, learn from her at landandleadership.org, right, Dee Dee?
Yes. And I also have my book, which is available in print and also in Kindle, which is called The Ecology of Care. The subtitle is Medicine, Agriculture, Money, and the Quiet Power of Human and Microbial Communities.
You are such a beacon, Dee Dee, and we're so grateful for when you made the shift into, you know, becoming an educator in this way that you've been. And it definitely is always inspiring to hear from you and to know that there are millions of people working on behalf of planetary health and the soil sponge, and there will be millions more, and we have to keep seeing that that's possible, even as there's still, you know, darkness on the other side, and like you said, people capitalizing on it. We just can keep going forward and keep working for the change that we know is possible.
Millions of people and trillions of other organisms.
Right. Of the essential workers, definitely the essential workers. We are could not exist without them. We honor them. So thank you so much again, Dee Dee, and more power to all of the work and all of the people that you're working with and collaborating with around the world.
Thanks so much, Gary. It's great to be with you.
Hey, listeners, to check out the extended recording of this show or to explore our other shows, subscribe to our podcast or visit our website at ecojusticeradio.org. This has been EcoJustice Radio and our show, How the Soil Sponge and Essential Biological Workers Are Changing the World. Thank you to our guest, Dee Dee Pursehaus, and thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please connect with us on social media at EcoJustice Radio, SoCal350, and Adventures in Waste. If you like what you've heard and you want others to be informed, subscribe and share the episode. Been listening to EcoJustice Radio, a project of SoCal 350. Executive producer Jack Eit, producer and co-host Jessica Aldridge, co-host Carrie Kim, and engineer and original music by Blake Quake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
Estás sintonizando KBOO Portland.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM.